About war, says today's guest, as long as you're not dying, is that it's oddly exhilarating. We'll find out why she says that and when in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and very pleased to introduce to you Linda Schuster, who is the author of Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Time of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. Linda Schuster, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Linda, this is a very interesting beginning to really a fascinating read. The thing about war, as long as you're not dying, is that it's oddly exhilarating. A lot of people would not exactly describe it as oddly exhilarating. So help us out.
Okay. Well, I think we should begin at the beginning. I grew up in Detroit, and the motto on the Indiana license plates back then was Wander, which I took as excellent advice for anyone raised in the region: grow up and leave. And part of this was rejecting my mother's life, which I thought was just very, very boring. She was a housewife, and it was part sort of requisite youthful rebellion, and also part desire to see the world. This desire was in some way fueled by a stamp collection that I had as a kid, which piqued my interest in far, far away places. The stamp in particular that really caught my attention was a green triangular one from Qatar that had Arabic calligraphy on it, and I think a camel and a man in an Arab headdress, and it just seemed exotic beyond belief to me. And so my message to parents is, be warned, keep those stamp collections away from your children. They tend to lead to all sorts of subversive ideas.
Sounds like good advice.
Yeah, right. So in pursuit of adventure, I finished high school early at age 17 and ran away from home to a kibbutz in the northern part of Israel. And about 5 minutes after I got there, the Yom Kippur War broke out. And instead of scaring me, it, as I wrote in the book, exhilarated me. And that's sort of how this whole interest in being in war and being in places of adventure started.
For those who don't know what a kibbutz is, explain what it is and actually how you got there from Detroit.
A kibbutz, well, they have changed radically over in the last decades, but back then it was a collective agricultural settlement, and was very much responsible for most of Israel's agriculture back then. And they had programs, since they needed people to help work on the land, they had programs for foreign students. If you could just get there, you could work half the day and study half the day, and they would provide you with room and board. And the way I got there was, since I knew that this was something I could do, I worked every day after school when I was in high school in a bakery, a Detroit bakery, and also on weekends. And unbeknown to my parents, that's what I was saving my money for.
Now, once you saved your money and actually got there, your parents knew where you were at that point, yes?
Yes, they did know.
All right. And so there you are, and all of a sudden things really begin to pop off. What was your initial thought and reaction?
So if your listeners can recall or know anything about it, that war in 1973 took Israel completely by surprise. The Egyptians attacked from the south and the Syrians from the north, and the Israeli government, I think it was a combination of hubris and just a complete misreading of all the intelligence. intelligence was totally unprepared for this, as was the kibbutz. So it was Yom Kippur, which in the Jewish religion is the holiest day of the year, and it's characterized by a 26-hour fast. And it's always incredibly hot, and the entire country shuts down on that day, and including the Voice of Israel, which is the radio station. So you really have no way of knowing what's going on. And there I am, this 17-year-old girl, sitting in a room that had air conditioning, the only place on the whole kibbutz that had air conditioning, when all of a sudden these massive explosions start are just happening all around me, and someone yelled that we were under attack and that we all should go to a bomb shelter, and we ran to a bomb shelter only to find them locked because, as I say, the kibbutz was as unprepared as the rest of the country.
You know, it's interesting. At one point early on in Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, you refer to your mom's life as relentlessly uninteresting. And it would seem to me that the difference between relentlessly uninteresting and trying to get into a locked bomb shelter, I might choose relentlessly uninteresting.
Yes, but think about being 17 years old.
Okay.
Remember, you have a sense of feet being immortal.
Indeed.
You have a sense of all the adventure is out there just waiting for you to it to happen. So it probably, you might have had a different mindset if this happened to you in your teens.
Maybe. She says begrudgingly. What was your family's reaction when they ultimately found out what was going on?
Well, I think it was, I'm sure they were horrified and terrified. That was a very, I mean, we're talking about the 70s. And back then, there was none of the sort of instant communications that we have now. There was no email. There was no texting. There was no instant messaging. There was only very, very expensive long-distance telephone calls and snail mail. So my mother read about it in the newspaper just like everybody else did, and I'm sure those dispatches were a day or two old by the time they got into the paper. And my parents were divorced at the time, and my father was living in London. And I think about 3 or 4 days into the war, he did manage to get a call through to the kibbutz, oddly enough. And I was in another bomb shelter, and there was shelling going on at the time, and it was very late at night. And some runner suddenly came into my bomb shelter and said, "Telephone call for Linda Schuster." Like, for all the world, I was sitting on a some beach somewhere, and I had to follow him through the night. There was a complete blackout, so the only way it was lit was when you would see these explosions, trying to follow him to this bunker. And I picked up the phone, and my father said, "Are you okay? You need to get out of there immediately." And I don't think he understood that I actually, the greatest danger I was in was in going from my bomb shelter to the next bomb shelter to get his telephone call.
So clearly you did not get out of there immediately.
No, I did not want to get out of there. Also, from a very practical point of view, the airport, the only international airport in the country, was shut. All vehicles had been commandeered, all private vehicles, or as many as was possible, had been commandeered by the military. People drove in their private cars to their bases in order to when they were called up to fight. And all the buses had been commandeered. There was no pub. There was no way of getting anywhere in the country at the time.
When you did get out, where did you go?
I went to, I ultimately went back to the Midwest and did my my undergraduate work there. And then the whole time I was sort of thinking, okay, how do I get back to the Middle East? How do I lead a life of adventure? I mean, this isn't going to happen magically, and nobody's going to support this lifestyle, so I need to figure this out. And I fell into journalism kind of by default because I was trying to figure out where to go to graduate school. And initially I thought I would have an academic career, and then sort of woke up in the middle of one night, and I was actually accepted into a PhD program, woke up in the middle of one night hyperventilating, thinking, I'm too young to die in academia. and that point, it was very late in the summer, and I saw something in the course catalog about a graduate program in journalism. No experience necessary, 2 years and you're out. So having decided on that career, I was very determined to spend as little time as possible working domestically. So I got very lucky in that respect, first to be hired by the Wall Street Journal directly out of journalism school, and then when the journal back then would fly you to New York to speak to all the, you know, on high editors there. And when they said to me, which domestic bureau of ours are you interested in working in? And I said, oh, I never want to work domestically. I only want to work internationally. And they nodded very understandingly and promptly dispatched me to their Dallas bureau.
Well, there you go.
A New Yorker, it probably is foreign. But I got very lucky because for some reason that bureau was responsible for covering Central America, which back in the early 80s was one of the hottest stories, international stories around. And so within a year out of journalism school, I was covering one of the hottest international stories around.
You know, what's interesting, as I was reading your book, even as truly as a youngster, you were, let's say, what's the word, intense, clear about your views. You talk about the day that your mom and dad came into the room, sat you down and said that they were getting a divorce, and you were furious with your mother because she was pleading with him not to leave.
Right. I was furious at my mother, and I realized, because he had, at that sort of little familial meeting where my siblings and I were informed, my father informed my siblings and I that he had fallen in love with another woman and was leaving my mother, and my mother is pleading with him to stay, and all I could think of was, where is your pride? I understand years later that fury was probably a bit misplaced, that it should have been directed at my father.
Maybe.
But that's all part of growing up.
True.
And that was all part of this growing up experience.
You know, there was another amusing episode, at least from where I sit, as you visited with your dad in London and you asked his partner to please be vigilant about taking birth control. Can you share that story?
I was such a horrible young person, I have to say. I left a little note on her pillow saying, please be vigilant about taking birth control. My sisters and I can't accept another sibling at this point in time. And I really, if anyone ever did that to me, I would not have countenanced it. And I have to go on the record saying that they ultimately married. They ultimately had a child who is one of my sisters and whom I adore greatly, and whom, when I published this book, I had to write her a letter saying, please don't be offended that I included this. I and everyone else just love you madly.
Well, as I said, you were unique, insistent, clear about your views. The idea that you were hired by the Wall Street Journal right out of school, for those listening who are aspiring to be journalists, how likely is that to happen today, do you think?
You know, I don't know. It's a different paper. First, let me explain that. The old journal, this is before it was taken over by the Murdoch people, the Murdoch Corporation. The Wall Street Journal still has a reputation of being an extremely conservative newspaper. Back then, it actually had a kind of bipolar sort of existence. On the one hand, and that's probably the wrong characterization of it, but on the one hand, the editorial page indeed was and still is very, very conservative. But there was a pretty good firewall between the news side, the news pages, and the editorial page. And the news pages prided themselves on hiring young reporters right out of school whom they saw as very promising and molding them. I think as one editor said to me, if you're going to develop bad habits, we want you to develop our bad habits. But having said that, it was incredibly competitive. So it was a huge honor, actually, to be hired right out of school by them. And I was very, very lucky.
And were there many women in the newsroom?
No. Certainly in the Dallas Bureau, I was the only, it was a bureau, I think, of about maybe 8 reporters, and I was the only woman. And I was, I'd say nowadays, bullied. It would be characterized as bullied. It was meant in good fun, but I was definitely bullied by the other reporters in the bureau.
How did you deal with it? I mean, you were still fairly young, yes?
Yeah, it was really frustrating. Here you are trying to establish yourself as a journalist, trying to be professional, living in a city that you're a stranger in. I mean, I moved down there knowing nobody, and trying to deal with all of these things. And the natural inclination, certainly, and certainly among all the other young male reporters in the bureau, was for them to be buddies. And here I was kind of like a little mascot, you know. It was tough. It was really tough. I was actually incredibly pleased when I got to work abroad and just basically spend all my time out of the bureau.
That is understandable. Before you even got to the bureau, I also noted, and I think it's important to talk about, particularly for those listening who are looking at beginning careers, you sent out 43 letters inquiring about employment. 43. And 42 of them said, gee, Linda, what?
Well, I had a rather unusual background because I did not major in journalism as an undergrad, because I hadn't worked on my high school paper. I only went in as a graduate student and then managed to get an internship back in Israel and then talked my way over the border into southern Lebanon, which had been invaded by Israel fairly recently, and got a tour of a war zone and then wrote a story about that for the Detroit paper. So I graduated with, first of all, only about, no more than a dozen clips. Usually aspiring journalists graduate from journalism school with a whole book full of clips. And all of my clips were from abroad. So these newspapers, and they were large newspapers and medium-sized and tiny newspapers, all wrote back to me and said, these are very nice stories from abroad, but can you do police beat? And I thought, wait a minute, I talked my way over an international border. If they don't think that that can't translate into covering city council, then they're missing something here.
And indeed they were.
Yeah. Because the Wall Street Journal looked at those clips and said, oh, nice, we'll take you.
Excellent. So one of the stories perhaps is that do not be deterred from your dream.
Not in the least. I'd say tenacity of purpose. Keep going. And as the head of my journalism program used to yell at me, do everything. Try everything and never give up.
Never give up. I think that's really so important. There are so many things that can get in one's way. Just as an aside from Dirty Wars and Polished Silver for a moment, what is your sense of what it is like for women in particular in the world of journalism and media today? Better, worse, challenging?
Oh, I think it's much better today. First of all, just by sheer numbers, you just see so many more female foreign correspondents. You see so many female print journalists. You see so many female producers now. But I'd say that just as there are huge challenges for women in any workplace environment, you still find those same challenges in journalism. But overall, I'd say it's reflective of society in general in that it has improved greatly.
So that perhaps is the good news.
That is good news. It is very good news. And it is a profession that I would encourage any and everyone, male or female, to pursue.
Let's go back to the Wall Street Journal. They hired you. You were doing your thing. You were doing your stories. At one point, you met someone by the name of Dial. Tell us about Dial.
Dial Torgerson was a veteran foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, whom I'd actually studied about in journalism school because he did something. He had been based in Israel. I did not meet him during my time there. And he managed to thwart the censors by flying, I think, to London to print a story that they did not want printed. And so I knew about him. And I met him on, I think, the second or third day of my very first reporting trip abroad, and was immediately smitten with him, even though he was quite a bit older than I.
I would say he must have been, given that you studied about him.
Yeah. let me put it this way. He was older than my father.
That's quite a bit older than you.
Yes.
Linda, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to hear more about Dial and Linda. We'll be right back, folks. About having met someone who you'd actually studied about when you were in school, in graduate school, someone who was indeed older than your dad. One would have an immediate picture of a sort of doddering old guy, sort of, you know, slowly getting up a step or two. Is that who Dial was?
No. Well, first of all, remember, I was in my 20s. So someone who's going to be older than my father was, Dial was in his early 50s. He was extremely athletic, extremely in very good shape, and he had gray hair, and he was a bit wrinkled, but he was in no way seemed old. In fact, he seemed far younger than my father to me.
And what was it like when you met him?
I had never met such a mix of humor, which to me is, you know, hands down the most essential element in anyone that I'm going to like. Humor and intelligence and he was a beautiful writer, absolutely beautiful writer, and a romantic, not in the sense of Hollywood romanticism, but a romantic about the world. I mean, this was a man who, when he would fly around the continents to various assignments, would read E.E. Cummings' poetry on the plane. I mean, who reads poetry on an airplane? And he just seized my mind and my heart in a way I had never been in love before. I'd obviously had boyfriends, but I fell head over heels in love with him.
Did the age difference disturb you or him?
It disturbed me only to the extent that, given that a lot of other people around me said, oh, this is a daddy thing, it made me question that aspect of it. A fellow reporter in the Dallas Bureau, who when he learned of it and happened to have been Dial's age, said, someone my age interested in someone in your age is only in it for one of two, you know, it can only be one of two or both reasons. It's either sex or ego or both. I think, you know, I can't, now that I have more than surpassed the age that Dial was when he met me, it is kind of amazing to me that he would have fallen in love. And I can't really put myself in his position. I know that generally for an older man to take up with a younger woman, this is considered a macho thing, but that isn't the way he approached it at all. I mean, he used to say to me, "You must be in love with me because I'm neither extremely handsome nor do I have money," which I guess is the only reason that a younger woman in his mind would take up with an older man.
You know, I was struck by a note that he left you in Costa Rica when he said, "Dial Torgerson fell in love at 11:37 p.m. on Thursday, October 1st.
With us. And when I got on the plane and opened up my typewriter to start typing out my story, much to the consternation of all the people who were trying to sleep around me, there was a rose in it and a little, a very romantic note. That's just the way he was.
So kind of hard not to fall in love.
Very hard. Very, very hard.
And you did fall in love.
I did. And we had this whirlwind romance where we would meet, because we worked for different newspapers and wrote different sorts of stories, he covered much more of what we in journalism would call the daily bang-bang, the firefights. This was, I mean, you have to remember that Central America had civil wars raging at the time and guerrilla insurgencies. But because I worked for the Wall Street Journal, so the LA Times wanted him to cover it in a much more conventional way. Because I worked for the Wall Street Journal and they consider themselves the paper of daily record only for business news, I could go to stories, spend a lot more time reporting them, and take the a long view. So what we tried to do was to coordinate as much as possible our stories. But it wasn't always easy, and oftentimes we would just end up with one day in one, you know, in one foreign capital somewhere, which obviously only sort of heightened the intoxication.
Sure.
But we did manage to get married in between assignments in Tegucigalpa, which is the capital of Honduras, and it was a very impromptu ceremony at City Hall. He arranged it and brought rings, and I think he had to bribe the registrar because you could only marry, I think, on a Tuesday, and maybe it was a Thursday. But yeah, we got married there, and then we went off. I mean, that was no honeymoon. Just he had to go back. I think the president of Mexico centralized the banking system, and I had to go off somewhere else, and that was it. That's what it's like to be married if you're a foreign correspondent.
And you were married for far too brief a time.
Yes. After we married, not long after we married, I was made Mexico bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, and actually moved my... I stopped working out of Dallas, where I was working nominally out of Dallas, and moved to Mexico, which meant that that's where Dial was based, and so we actually could live together as husband and wife. Except now I was pretty much confined to Mexico, and he was still very much covering Central America. So in reality, even though we were living together, we saw each other less. And then one night I had been out covering a story in Mexico, and I came back to the apartment, and I got a call at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was the Mexico City bureau chief, who was a friend of mine, and he was crying. And he didn't even have to tell me what he was going to... I already knew what he was going to tell me, because if it's 1 in the morning and the Mexico bureau chief is on the phone and he's crying, you know exactly what he's going to say.
Right.
And he told me that Dial had been in a car with a photographer down on the Honduran-Nicaraguan border, and their car went over a landmine and killed them both instantly.
How long had you been married at that point?
10 months.
I cannot imagine.
I was a bride at 25 and a widow at 26.
It's hard to imagine.
It was. It was. It was devastating. Absolutely devastating. I mean, I never had any illusions about how much time we would have together. I figured, you know, best case scenario, you know, 20 years, 25 years. 10 months seemed just far too short.
Well, and he at one point was actually talking about growing your family and had commented on the time that you would have together. And this just was shocking.
Yeah, the last conversation we ever had together, he managed the last weekend of his life. He managed to come home to Mexico City, and we had a talk about when I was going to become pregnant. And of course, I, in my just, you know, stupid young woman, everything career mindset, couldn't even fathom stopping long enough to have a child. But he talked about he had two children from a previous marriage. And he talked about how those were some of the happiest moments of his life, raising his children, and how he had missed out on so much of it because he and his wife divorced when the children were relatively young. And that was the last conversation we ever had in person.
You, at one point, wanted to do a story about his death. What happened?
Yes. Well, it was very unclear because of the U.S. involvement in Honduras and in funding the Contras, the counter-revolutionary guerrillas who were fighting to overthrow the Marxist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And this, if your listeners may recall, this was illegal. This led to the Iran-Contra scandal. So we had some very dirty dealings down there. And the Honduran government basically, I think, at the behest of the American government, claimed that Dial and the photographer had been killed by the Nicaraguans, when in fact the evidence pointed to the fact that the Contras might have killed him, which meant that it was our tax money, our illegal tax money, had killed my husband. And the LA Times at a certain point just decided that they were going to accept the Honduran government's explanation of what happened. And I was furious, and I got a very quick lesson in what it's like to be on the other side. This was very much a sort of Alice through the looking glass experience. And in my grief, and I was pretty much out of my mind with grief, I wanted to go back to Honduras and do an investigative piece about it, and was talked out of it by my editors in New York. Their feeling was that they weren't going to sanction that, and I said, I will go off and just do this rogue, I will do this freelance. And they said, have you thought about, first of all, your own safety, and second of all, that you would lack credibility being the grieving widow? And that rang true, and so in the end, I did not go.
What did you do instead?
I asked my editors to transfer me out of Latin America because that's where I had met Dial, that's where we had fallen in love, that's where we had gotten married, and they were very sympathetic and transferred me to Beirut, which was then in the middle of a civil war. And that's where they sent me to recover. And I really don't think they meant any malice by it. That's just where they had a space open.
That's quite the recovery land.
No, it's not. I would not recommend that to anyone.
What was that like for you when you got there? I mean, you had no time, it would seem to me, and no space to really recover.
None. And I was really stupid about it. I mean, no one had ever died on me before, as it were. I mean, obviously my grandparents had died at some point, but that was all in the natural course of things. They had a long life, they grew ill, they died. I was very, very sad about that, but it was a completely different sort of thing than to lose the person you love most in the world in such a tragic fashion and such a horrifying fashion and so quickly. If I had any sense about it and any sense of maturity and knowing what I know now, I would probably have insisted on staying or made myself stay in Mexico City and work through the grieving. By being sent to Beirut, it took all the energy I had just to stay alive. This was just after 243 U.S. Marines had been blown up in their barracks. Beirut was one of the scariest places I ever was, and it really did take all the energy I could just to stay alive. And I think it, to a certain extent, delayed the grieving process, and it made me a little crazy. I think just anyone being in Beirut was a little crazy, but to have this on top of it made, I think, only exacerbated it.
And being a woman in Beirut?
You know, I think there was this weird thing that happened. I think generally being a woman foreign correspondent, war correspondent, at least in the places that I worked, it was an advantage because most of the places I worked were developing societies, very traditional societies in which men were very solicitous toward women. So I could often get interviews that my male counterparts couldn't. Having gotten my foot in the door, though, it was often a challenge to make the interviewee take me seriously. So they'd let me in the door because they're being polite, but then they'd look at me as, oh, you're just a woman. I think the only real advantage a man ever that my male counterparts ever had over me was in the area of bodily functions, which I think they could finesse much better on the front lines. But this other weird thing happened when I was in Beirut. It was like I had this big W written across my, you know, my shirt for widow. Mm. And I had these men showing up at all hours of the night at my hotel door trying to ask me out or pick me up. And that was obviously very distressing because I had no interest in this.
Right. And strange.
Very strange. And again, I don't know if it was a function of me being like there was some guy who kept saying to me that he was a Polish shipping agent. Now understand, the Beirut port had been closed for months. There was no shipping in Beirut. But he claimed he was a Polish shipping agent who wanted to take me on a picnic in a war zone.
And
so
you turned
figure that one out.
Don't tell me you turned that one down.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, who wouldn't want to sit out in a blanket listening to the shells go whistling overhead?
I can't imagine why you would turn that one down. I have to ponder that. In fact, I think we'll take a break while I ponder that. And then we will come back and continue our conversation. Folks, I am speaking with Linda Schuster, author of Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. And we'll find out about that next title when we return. reference another hat that you came to wear. How did that occur?
So after, obviously, having the person you love most in this world killed doing his job, which is also your job, sort of made me begin to have second thoughts about the career. But I still very much believed in it as a mission and as very, very necessary for democracy. I think journalism is absolutely essential. And I also had this very practical problem of this is the only thing I knew how to do. So after the Middle East, after a year, I was twitching in the Middle East, and I asked my editors to transfer me, and there was a stint in South America, and then I was very fortunate to cover the fall of apartheid, or what were sort of the final throes of apartheid in South Africa. And while I was doing that, I was targeted by assassins, and this was a time when the white minority government was not going to give up without a fight, and there were death squads roaming the country, and they ended up assassinating some very, very important people in the anti-apartheid struggle, and they didn't like the stories I was writing. And at that point, I had been very fortunate to fall in love again. This was with an American diplomat who tried to pick me up during an interview. And I just want to go on record to say that it didn't work, at least not the first time.
Good for you.
Thank you. And he was being posted to Monrovia, Liberia, and he proposed marriage. And I thought, okay, I think I've done enough of this. I can get married. I can trade in the reporter's notebook for the little pillbox hat and white gloves, and I can still live a life of adventure and write about the world, but I can be safe. And so, obviously, as I write in the book, that didn't always turn out that way, but that was the quid pro quo. I would give up the journalism life for the wife of an ambassador's spouse, and I'd be safe.
And as you said, safe was not always safe.
No. One of the things that happened was when we went to my husband's posting in Lima, Peru, my husband was at a, first of all, our house in Lima had been blown up 4 times by guerrillas. And the last time it was blown up, 2 people were killed. Anytime we went out in Lima, we traveled with a 10-car bulletproof convoy. A 3-car bulletproof convoy, but with 10 armed bodyguards. And this was just to go out to get pizza. And every night, 30 armed Peruvian soldiers would surround the house and take up positions in concrete bunkers. And then, to top it all off, not long after we got to Lima, my husband was at a diplomatic reception at the Japanese ambassador's residence. This was their national day. He left that reception, and 30 minutes later, about 15 guerrillas armed with submachine guns and tear gas and grenades attacked the party, took hundreds of hostages, including 10 of the officers from the American embassy. And this was a siege. If your listeners are readers of Anne Patchett, the novelist, this was the incident that was the basis of her book Bel Canto. So she fictionalized it, that my husband lived this. But he escaped being taken prisoner, and he would have been their prize pig, believe me. To capture the American ambassador and haul him out with the submachine gun pointed at his head, they would have loved it.
Absolutely.
Missed that by just 30 minutes.
Was it time to come back to the United States?
Yeah. I found myself, I never wanted to have children. This was all part of my silly youthful rebellion. Until such a time that one day I woke up, I think, completely overcome by biology and decided that I did want a child. And this was in my late 30s. And without getting into, this might be too much information, but my husband, who had had a vasectomy years earlier, was very kind and had it reversed. And I was very fortunate to find out that I was pregnant before we got to Lima. And I gave birth in Peru. And this whole hostage-taking crisis happened while I was pregnant.
Oh, my.
And at a certain point, I just said to my husband, this is it. Enough. I will go back to Washington with you. But once our daughter was born, I didn't want her to grow up, A, as the ambassador's daughter, and which is a very privileged, I'd say, spoiled position, and B, I didn't want to have to worry at all about her safety in that respect.
Makes sense. And so here you are.
Yes. Almost back where my mother was. And happily so.
I was going to say, so mom's life was not so bad after all, perhaps.
No, it wasn't. And sadly, so I don't live in Detroit. I live in Pittsburgh, which is a great, great city. And our daughter is now grown up and attending college. And unfortunately, my mother died very suddenly about 10 years ago. And I just hope that she had our relationship improved dramatically after I had my daughter. And she and my daughter had a really close relationship. And I think she understood how stupid I was as a young teenager. And I think she understood, I hope she understood, that I gave validation to her life. To raise four children is no mean thing. I mean, it is a hard job. And I didn't really appreciate it. It's like anything in life. You don't really appreciate it until you do it.
And I think equally as important as her understanding was your understanding.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I just hope that my daughter, all of our children are judgmental. We know that. It's part of youthful rebellion. I hope she's just a little bit more open-minded than I was.
If she were to come home today and say, "See you, Mom, I'm going off to be a war correspondent," what would you say?
I would have to bite my hypocritical mother's tongue and wish her all the best. Obviously, I would talk to her. You know, being a war correspondent nowadays is a lot different. I think it's a lot more dangerous because by virtue of the advances in the profession, back when I did it, we journalists were the only means of presidents and kings and warlords getting out their message. Nowadays, everyone from a president to a terrorist has his own Twitter account. I'm not equating the two, but they all have their Twitter accounts and their Facebook pages, and the job has become that much more dangerous because we are not necessary anymore. In some ways, we are seen as impediments. So I would argue that, give her that argument, and if she were still absolutely determined, I would say, just text me every now and then so I know you're okay.
Well, and at least nowadays, she, in theory, could text you.
She could, absolutely, unlike back when I did it. And I have to say, my mother wasn't, I think my father was far more cognizant of the world and geography and world affairs than my mother was. I think a little bit of ignorance was absolute bliss on her part because she might have had a nervous breakdown otherwise.
I would think so. I mean, I just can't imagine her knowing where you were and what you were potentially exposed to and not being a complete nervous wreck every moment of every day.
Yes, and actually one of my sisters, after reading my book, called me up and said, "I didn't realize you were in this much danger." Right, well, I can write about it now.
Being in danger, I mean, knowing that at any moment your life could be not your own, was that something that you would think about, or was the story the job?
Well, I think I would be not, I would be less than truthful if I didn't say that you become terrified at times. And I think the nature of the job is that it becomes terrifying. I think at a certain point, a lot of people become inured to it, and you have to tell yourself you're out there doing a job. And I, you know, you see a lot of people in the profession taking really silly chances. You see it more with war photographers whose job is to run right into that firefight that all of us are trying to hunker down and keep away from but still write about. And again, let me reiterate that I worked for a newspaper that luckily and happily did not want me, you know, running into that gun battle. But it takes a huge toll on the people who practice the profession. I saw a lot of alcoholism. I saw a lot of broken marriages. I also saw a lot of people who became addicted to the profession, a lot of what we called action junkies who just couldn't keep away from the bang-bang, and once they were brought home stateside, just couldn't adjust.
Would you say that it makes sense, and particularly when you're in any kind of dangerous profession, that you find ways to heal for yourself, whether it's working with a professional or learning deep breathing or just taking a hot shower, assuming that you have access to one? Is that important?
Oh, I think it's really important. And I think, and again, at the risk of sounding sort of reverse sexist, as I write in my book, and I am not ashamed to say this, I would go back to my room and cry sometimes because it just became overwhelming. I know my male counterparts didn't do that because they had to put up, you know, there's a certain swagger that goes with being a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent. Crying was a great outlet, and it also made me stay in touch with my humanity, because I do think you can become inured to that. And once you do, I think you're doing a great disservice to your readers.
You talked about, speaking of tears as being a release, you talked about having met a woman who I think was sleeping under a tree with 14 grandchildren. And that really sent you back to your room in tears.
Yes. This woman, I think, if I recall the story, this was in El Salvador, and I think the government soldiers had come through and thought that the townspeople were collaborating with guerrillas, and so I think they kidnapped her daughters, which meant and burned her house, and she was living in a refugee camp, or she was living under a tree because she, I don't even think there was room for her in a refugee camp, with her daughter's children. And I met her, I think, at a human rights office in San Salvador, where she was looking through the most gruesome pictures of people who had, of bodies that had not been identified, in the hope of finding her daughters. Just the whole story, I mean, just pick one piece of that story, and even just one piece of that story is enough to make you cry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You said something a few minutes ago. You said that you thought that journalism was really an essential part of a democracy. And in today's world, journalism, fake news, what do you think about this whole dilemma?
I think it is so dangerous to our democracy. I mean, there's a reason that the concept of a free press and freedom of speech is enshrined as the First Amendment, the first meaning the most important. Without a free press, and by denigrating the press, you are calling into question its veracity. Without a free press, you cannot have an informed electorate. And without an informed electorate, you do not have a democracy. And I don't care what side of the political spectrum you come down on, this is a non-issue. I mean, there is no argument here. We need a free press, and we need a press that is free to practice the profession and that is not denigrated at the highest levels of our government.
Period.
Yes, and end the quote.
Linda Schuster, author of Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. Linda, where can folks find out more about what you're doing, find out more about the book?
The book you can find at your local independent bookstores, which I hope everyone will support. You can find it on Amazon. And I have a website with the very original name of lindaschuster.com.
I like that name. Can you spell it for us?
LYNDASCHUSTER, all one word.
.com. All right. lindaschuster.com is the place to go.
And all lowercase.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Thank you for the book. Thank you for the work that you've done. There's so much passion and so much power in your book. Thank you very much for that and for your time today.
You are very welcome. It was fabulous talking to you.
I can only say the same. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It's available on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play stores. And folks, I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So please do send me an email. Let me know where you are. And also, if you've got any questions or comments or suggestions for Mind Talk programs, by all means, send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.